This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Every weekday, we talk with public officials, business and education leaders, nonprofit organizations, and more about the issues of the day as we work hard to help you stay connected with local news and information. Now, here's Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here, Kyle Bailey. And a unique program today because Joni Komodo joining us from the Portland area. She gave a presentation at Umpqua Valley Arts over the weekend about her experience being incarcerated in Minidoka in Hunt, Idaho. And she joins us on the phone. Thanks for being on today. We appreciate you telling your story with us.
Thank you, Kyle, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. It's pretty exciting to be able to have this conversation with you and your listeners.
So when all this started, you were very young. When your family was taken, where were you living then?
I was living in Portland, Oregon. I was a little girl. I really have no memory of this period of time. But of course, all these stories were stories that I gathered over the years, my parents, and this is what I know. Yes, I was in Portland when the war broke out.
And you know, I think about, you know, what I remember about when I was three or four or five, and it's not a lot about specific things. But I have to imagine that at some level, you knew something really unusual was going on when your family was taken.
Yes, absolutely. There are some faint memories, more to do with having to give up things and not being able to have the things that I was used to having. I had animals and a little dog and a cat and my toys and all of that. I wasn't able to have with me anymore. They were taken away. They were not part of my life.
Now, during World War II, a number of Japanese Americans had this happen. And you're a third generation, and I don't know if I'm saying this correctly. Is it Sansei?
Sansei.
Sansei.
Yeah, Sansei, S-A-N-S-E-I. Yes, I'm a third-generation Japanese-American, and my parents were Niseis. They were American-born Japanese, and they are Niseis, and my grandparents were Iseis. So I don't know if you know the Japanese numbers, Ichi, Ni, San. Well, that's kind of how to remember this is Isei, Nisei, Sansei.
So you mentioned not being able to take things. What were you not allowed to take?
Well, we weren't. We had what happened after we were ordered. Executive Order 9066 is the what was the order that told us that we had to report. We had 7 to 10 days to get rid of everything, leave our homes, and take only what we could take, what we could carry. So that left us with very little. They did give my parents a list of essentials that they were to take, a few essential dishes and pots and pans and linens, and clothes were to be minimized. We had no preparation for the kind of weather that we were going to be in, so my little suitcase had just the bare essentials of clothing, and I was able to take one doll with me.
Wow. And how did all this roll out, this executive order? What was the reasoning behind this?
The reasoning behind executive order basically was when America went to war with Japan, when Pearl Harbor bombed, when Japan came over and bombed Pearl Harbor, that was the disaster that happened. But that was also the impetus that led to our being incarcerated. We were considered a threat to national security, espionage, sabotage, And it really was based on racism, the way that we looked. We just happened to look just like the enemy that America was at war with. And that order led to the our incarceration and of 125,000 Japanese living on the West Coast. And two-thirds of us were Americans, and one-third were Japanese immigrants like my grandparents. So they considered us a danger to our community.
So your extended family then was incarcerated as well?
That's correct. And I actually had four generations, which is really unusual. I had a great-grandmother, my grandfather, my parents, and myself. So there were four generations incarcerated. And we were first taken after we were given the 10 days to get rid of everything, and that would include my parents' business, what was sold for. They had a little grocery store, and it was sold for pennies on the dollar, and they had to give away everything. Our bank accounts were frozen, and we were then taken to the Pacific International Livestock Exhibition Center here in Portland. And there were approximately 3,700 of us from Portland and Central Washington living there. What that center was a place that they housed livestock, and they hastily set up stalls for us. We had a little room, a little space of 8x10, and it was there that we spent 4 months until a more permanent place was ready for us, and that would have been Minidoka.
And where was the Minidoka? Where was this in Idaho?
It was in Hunt, Idaho, the south part of that state. Go ahead.
Well, what kind of facility were you housed out there? What had it been before you folks were sent there?
You mean at Minidoka?
Yeah.
It was government land, and it was actually the former home of the Shoshone-Bannock Native American tribe, and they were long gone, and we, of course, that was vacant land that the government had, federal lands, and that was perfect, I think, for where we wanted to live, because it was remote, and it was many, many miles away from civilization, for population.
That had to be, even as a child, that had to be really rough to take.
Yes, it was. I have memories of that. I do have memories of that. It was the extreme of everything. We lived in tarred paper barracks. When we arrived on a train from the livestock center here in Portland, and after 4 months, you know, we were transferred there, not knowing where we would be. We were taken there, and I have this memory of my mother, and my mother did tell me this, and said, when we arrived, there was a dust storm, and it was so severe that it was like needles hitting our faces. And my mother covered my face, and she was crying, and she said to me, "This is our home, and this is where we will live."
Wow.
Yeah, it was of extreme weather. That first winter, it was 20 degrees below zero. We lived in a room that was more suited for the military. They were barracks. And so we lived in a room with one potbelly stove, no cooking facilities, no bathrooms. We slept on army cots, and we had two blankets each.
Wow. Now, how long were you guys there?
Actually, my family was there for 2 years. Most everyone was there for 3 years, from 42 to until the war ended in 45. My father, however, was able to leave camp in 44 because he was offered a job to work in the Midwest in Chicago. There was a labor shortage, and so he was sponsored by a a Jewish man who offered him a job as a washing machine repairman. And so we were able to leave 2 years after being there.
Now, while you were in Idaho, were you given, did they do schooling?
Yes, I did have school. In fact, I went to kindergarten there, and we had barracks that we lived in, and we had to leave for everything. We had, as I mentioned earlier, we had no cooking facilities, no bathrooms, so we left our barrack and went to another barrack to eat, to use the latrines, to go to school. And the school that was the kindergarten school that I was on happened to be on the same block I was on. I was on block 32. There were 44 blocks. And each of the blocks, as I mentioned, had so many barracks living on each block. And there was a school on mine. So I was educated, yes.
But what did you do the rest of the time?
Very little. Played. I went out in the desert. I was able to visit friends and family. There's a little bit of humor to this that I speak of when I do a lot of my presentations. And I was a friendly little girl, apparently, and I loved to go visit my relatives who lived on other blocks. And so, and whenever I would return back to my barrack, I was never able to go and eat dinner because I was always full because all my relatives used to give me treats to eat. And so my father made me a red, white, and blue cardboard sign that I was to put around my neck every time I left my barrack. And the sign read, "Please do not feed me."
Oh, gee. So
there was a little bit of humor in that. But yeah, most of my life as a child in camp was it was different. You know, we had no bicycles or tricycles to ride on. We had a playground. But, you know, as a child, you learn to adapt. You learn, no matter, I didn't know that I was being inconvenienced. I understood that this is my home. I was protected by my parents. And so my life was pretty protected. It was my parents who really suffered immensely from all of this.
Were they able to communicate with any of their friends in Portland during this time?
No. They had maybe some letters that were written, but they basically lost all their connection. I really don't know. My mother and father really never spoke much about that, but their friendship became very strong with the people that they lived with. They made a lot of friends while they were living in Minidoka, and that is what they used to talk about. They never talked about the hardships they suffered, the injustices that they lived under, the lack of freedom they had, because all they talked about was the good times, the things that they were able to remember with friendship and community. And I think that was what made them go through this period of their lives bearable, because that really is what kept them, you know, I think gave them a sense of sanity and a sense of normalcy was their community.
So when you got out and being able to get out a little bit ahead of other people, how did you kind of go back to sort of more life as normal?
Well, I personally went through a great deal of trauma. When I left camp, are you speaking about after we left camp and went regular community? Yes. There was what we call intergenerational trauma. I was affected greatly by that because as a child growing up in an environment like that, I knew nothing else. I only knew people that look like me. And when I left the camps, I was now in Chicago, and it was there that I faced a great deal of trauma, because I had the identity of being somebody who was the enemy, and children would bully me, and it was extremely hard to understand why I was being treated this way. So I went through a lot, and then I moved into an all-white community in a very rural place here in Oregon. My mother had actually sent me away because of the hardships I was experiencing in Chicago, and I went to a small grade school in Tillamook, Oregon, to live with an aunt. And it was there, too, that I experienced being different. And that was an extremely difficult time for me, adjusting to being the only minority in a rural school. And children there would, you know, wonder why I looked the way I did. And I remember telling them that I was an American just like them.
So did you finish growing up then in Tillamook?
Yeah, in Tillamook for a year, and then I moved back to Portland. Yeah.
So what did you do after you got out of high school?
After high school, I went to a college for a couple of years. My parents were having a difficult time getting back to life again. It was very difficult after coming back from Chicago, back into Portland. We all lived in Portland then, and our life was very difficult, just readjusting. I went to college. Financially, my parents had a hard time, so I was only able to go to 2 years of college. And then I met my husband after that and got married and moved to Hawaii. But I did have different kinds of careers. I was busy raising my family. I had two daughters. My eldest daughter, Lonnie, lives in Roseburg now. And then I have another daughter, Kelly, who's also in Roseburg.
So, wow, that's amazing to go through. Now, when you were raising kids, did you work outside the home, or did you just focus on that?
Oh, okay. When I was raising children here in Portland, I had a career. I worked for an engineering company, and I worked for 16 years for this engineering company who manufactured and designed equipment for the pulp and paper industry that was really booming in those years. And then my husband was self-employed. He had a business, and I left my job and became part of our business, which was export trade. So I worked with that, and I was self-employed, helping with the work that my husband had, as well as myself.
And Joni Komodo is with us. We've got about 4 minutes left in the segment talking about it, all of this. So you go to Hawaii, you end up back in Portland eventually. I'm sure there's not a day goes by that you don't remember something about this whole situation.
Yes, there isn't a day that goes by. I'm pretty involved today with the work that I do. I'm in the latter part of my life, but about 20 years ago, I started becoming involved just a little bit with my Japanese heritage by being a docent at a museum. I had been retired, and my late husband from Hawaii had passed on, and I was filling my life with wanting to do something. So I started to be involved with working at the Japanese American Museum here in Portland, and I was a docent, and then I became on the Speakers Bureau, and then it just started growing. And now that's pretty much what I do in my retirement years. I'm now remarried, to a wonderful man, and he has been very supportive of everything I do. And I'm now speaking to colleges and clubs and institutions and to the public, and I'm very involved with social justice work. And this being invited to the museum, I mean, not the museum, but the art center, was really an experience for me to be in Roseburg. I had the opportunity through my daughter, Lonnie, to have these Japanese family heirlooms being displayed at the Umpqua Art Center. And that really, that's the first time they have ever been out for public display. But had it not been for two people during the war years to house these heirlooms for my parents, I wouldn't have these today. And this was a tradition that was in our family for many, many years. And I am very thankful that they were saved for us, because we're able to carry on this tradition that we've had. That's a 1,000-year-old tradition of displaying these beautiful dolls. So this was something that was an opportunity, gave me the opportunity. And I was also asked to speak about the Japanese experience, which I did on Saturday.
Wow. The display is currently on display at the Umpqua Valley Arts Center on West Harvard Avenue, open Tuesday through Saturday. So that's going to be available for people to come by and check out. That's going to be on my list of things to do. I want to go see that. We have a minute left. What last thing would you like to share with people?
Well, the most important thing is to talk about my life experience. There was so little written in textbooks. I am a survivor, and I think it's important for the future generation to understand what happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II, and that this now has, we now have some echoes of the same type of thing happening today, and that people have to be aware that, you know, this is that we have to be aware of each other, and government abuses of power sometimes causes people to be treated unjustly. This is what I really would like to end my story with. And the fact is that there's so little today that is being in education. And these are stories that need to be told and retold.
Joni Komodo with us. Thanks for being on today. We look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kyle. I appreciate this.
1259 News Radio, 93.9 FM, 1240 KQEN.
This has been Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Listen every weekday afternoon at 12:30 to stay connected with what's happening in your community. Today's interview will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it with others and let them know where they can hear it. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.